"There," she said to Dint proudly. "Now we kill it, no problem." She hefted the sword happily in one hand. As a teenager in Brooklyn, Quentin had often imagined himself engaging in martial heroics, but after this he knew as a cold and immutable fact that he would do anything necessary, sacrificing whatever or whomever he had to avoid risking exposure to physical violence. He wasn't even ashamed. Shame never came into it. He embraced his new identity as a coward. He would run in the other direction. He would lie down and cry and put his arms over his head or play dead. It didn't matter what he had to do. He would do it and be glad. They trailed after Dint and Finn. And what kind of retarded names were those anyway, Dint and Finn, he thought numbly, through the doorway and into the hill. He barely noticed his surroundings. A square stone corridor opened out into a huge open chamber that looked almost as big as the hill that contained it, which must have been mostly hollow. Green-tinted light filtered down through a circular oculus at the room's apex. The air was full of stone dust. The ruins of an enormous brass orrery stood in the center of the room, its skinny arms stripped of its planets. It looked like a broken, defoliated Christmas tree, the smashed spheres lying at its base like fallen ornaments. Nobody noticed a large, 10 feet long large, green lizard standing frozen amid the remains of shattered tables and benches until it abruptly unfroze and skittered off into the shadows, claws scritching on the stone floor. The horror was almost pleasant. It wiped away Alice and Janet and everything else except itself like a harsh, abrasive cleanser. They wandered from room to empty room, down echoing stone hallways. The floor plan was beyond chaotic. The stonework changed styles and patterns every 20 minutes as a new generation of masons took over. They took turns putting light spells on their knives, their hands, various inappropriate body parts in an effort to break the tension. Having tasted blood, Anaïs now tagged after Dint and Fenn, like an eager puppy, lapping up whatever observation she could get out of them about personal combat. "They never had a chance," Fenn said with professional disinterest. "Even if Dint hadn't taken the second one, even if I had been alone, the quarterstaff is not a collaborative weapon. It simply takes up too much room. Once the tall one is into a form, those tips are flying left and right, up and down. He can't afford to worry about his friend. You face them one-on-one, and you move on." "They should have fallen back, waited for us together in that big chamber, taken us by surprise." Anaïs nodded, obviously fascinated.
"Why didn't they?" she asked. "Why did they come running straight at us?"
"I don't know," Finn frowned. "Could have been an honor thing. Could have been a bluff. They thought we'd run. Could be they were under a spell. They couldn't help it."
"Did we have to kill them?" Quentin burst out. "Couldn't we have just... I don't know."
"What?" Anaïs turned on him, sneering. "Maybe we could have taken them prisoner. We could have rehabilitated them."
"I don't know," he said helplessly.
This wasn't how it was supposed to work.
"Tied them up? Look, I guess I just wasn't that clear on what it would actually be like, killing people."
It made him think of the day the beast appeared. That same bottomless feeling, all bets off, like the cable had snapped and they were in free fall.
"Those are not people," Anaïs said. "Those were not people, and they tried to kill us first."
"We were breaking into their home."
"Glory has its price," Penny said. "Did you not know that before you sought it?"
"Well, I guess they paid the price for us, huh?"
To Quentin's surprise, Elliot rounded on him, too.
"What, you're going to back out? You?"
Elliot laughed a bitter, barking laugh.
"You need this almost as badly as I do."
"I'm not backing out, I'm just saying..." Quentin had time to wonder why exactly Elliot did need this before Anaïs cut them off.
Oh, God, please, can we not?
She shook her curly head in disgust. Can we all just not? 4 hours and 3 flights of stairs and 1 mile of empty corridor later, Quentin was examining a door when it opened suddenly, hard, smacking him in the face. He took a step backward and put a hand to his upper lip. In his half-stunned state, he was more preoccupied with whether or not his nose was bleeding than with who or what had just slammed the door into it. He raised the back of his hand to his upper lip, checked it, raised it again, then checked it again. Yep, definitely bleeding. An elfin being stuck its narrow, angry face around the edge of the door and glared at him. Purely by reflex, Quentin kicked it shut. He'd been about to point out the door to the others, who were busy surveying a wide, low-ceilinged room with a dry basin in the center. A creeping, ivy-like plant had grown out of the basin and halfway up the walls, and then died. Daylight was a months-ago memory. There were twinkly lights going off behind Quentin's eyes, and his nose felt like a warm, melting gob of something salty and throbbing. With melodramatic slowness, the door creaked open again, gradually revealing a slight, pointy-featured man wearing black leather armor. He didn't look particularly surprised to see Quentin. The man, elf, whatever, whipped a rapier out of his belt and snapped into a formal fencing stance. Quentin backed away, gritting his teeth with fear and resignation. Just like that, Fillory had vomited out another one of its malignant menagerie. Maybe fatigue had dulled the edge of his fear, but almost unbeknownst to himself, Quentin was enunciating the words to Penny's magic missile spell. He'd practiced it back in New York, and now he backpedaled as he cast it, because the black elf, as Quentin tagged him, was advancing on him using a poncy sideways fencing shuffle, his free hand held aloft, wrist limp. Quentin was getting the spell right, he could feel it, and he was loving himself for getting it right. Terror and physical pain sharpened and simplified Quentin's moral universe. He snapped the magical darts straight into the elf's chest. The black elf coughed and sat down hard, looking dismayed. His face was the perfect height for kung fu kicking, so Quentin, in what felt like an act of consummate bravery, kicked him savagely in the face. The rapier clattered to one side.
Ha! Quentin shouted. It was like when he'd fought Penny, when the fear had left him. Was this battle rage at last? Was he going to become a berserker like Fenn? It felt so good to stop being afraid. Nobody else in the room had noticed what was going on, not until he yelled. Now the scene tilted and slid into nightmare. 4 more black elves scrambled through the open door, carrying an assortment of weapons, followed by 2 goat-legged men and 2 terrifying flying giant bumblebees the size of basketballs. Also present was something fleshy and headless that scrambled along on 4 legs, and a silent, wispy figure composed of white mist. With the 2 teams arranged on their respective sides of the room, a staring match ensued. It all reminded Quentin powerfully of the opening moments of a game of dodgeball. His body seethed. He wanted to cast the missile spell again. He'd gone from feeling frail and vulnerable and cowardly to feeling badass and supercharged and armor-plated. The 2 mercenaries were whispering and pointing, choosing up targets. Fenn picked up a pebble and tossed it lightly, sidearm, at one of the fawns. They had evil fawns now? Who let it bounce off a round leather buckler strapped to his forearm. He looked pissed. "The grimling's the problem," Quentin heard Fenn say to Dint. "Yeah, leave the pangborn, though. I have something for that." Dint withdrew a wand from his cape and appeared to write something in the air with it. He said a couple of words into the tip like it was a microphone. Then he indicated one of the fawns with it, a conductor cueing a soloist. The fawn burst into flame. It was like it was made of magnesium soaked in gasoline and had just been waiting for an errant spark to set it off. No part of it was not on fire.
It took a step backward, then turned to the goat man next to it as if to say something. Then it fell down, and Quentin couldn't look at it anymore. As all hell broke loose, he tried to hang on to the gleeful bloodlust he'd felt so clearly a moment ago, to fan it back into life, but he'd lost it, fumbled it in the confusion. Fen was thriving. This was evidently what she trained for. Quentin had missed it before, but she was actually mixing in a little magic as she fought. Her ink aga was a hybrid technique, a martial art fully integrated with some highly specialized spellcasting style. Her lips moved, and there were white flashes where her fist and hand strikes landed. Meanwhile, Dint addressed himself to the ghostly, misty figure, saying something inaudible that caused it to struggle and then be dispersed by an invisible, soundless, roaring gale. Quentin took a quick inventory of his brave company. Elliot had made himself useful by casting a kinetic spell on the second satyr, pinning it safely to the ceiling. Anaïs had her short sword out. It had a moonlight shimmer to it now, which meant she'd put a sharpness charm on it, and was looking eagerly around for somebody to stick it into. Janet was hugging herself against the back wall, her face wet and shining with tears. Her eyes were blank. She was gone. Too many things were happening at once. Quentin's stomach clenched when he realized an elf had singled Alice out and was advancing across the dry basin toward her, twirling a long, straight knife, were they called poniards, in each hand. It was obvious from Alice's face that every spell she'd ever learned had just now slipped her mind. She turned away, dropped to one knee, and locked her hands behind her head. Nobody in the history of all the conflicts in the world had ever looked more defenseless. He only had time to feel all the tenderness he had ever felt for her surge up in one infinitely concentrated instant, and to be surprised that it was all still there, moist and intact beneath the unsightly, scorched layer of his anger. Before the back of Alice's blouse tore wide open, and a small, leathery biped clawed its way vigorously out of the skin of her back. It was a party trick, a showgirl bursting out of a cake. Alice had loosed her cacodemon. No question, the cacodemon was instantly the happiest being in the room. This was exactly the party it wanted to be at. Facing the elf, it bounced on its toes like a wiry little tennis pro preparing for return of service, with triple match point on its side. Its leap was evidently several beats faster than its opponent had counted on. In a moment it was past the poniards and had fastened its wiry grip on the elf's upper arms and buried its horrible face in the soft hollow of the elf's throat. The elf gagged and sawed futilely at the demon's shark-skinned back with its knives. Quentin reminded himself for at least 100th time never to underestimate Alice again. And just like that, it was over. They were out of opponents. The elves and the bees were down. The room was full of acid smoke from the burned satyr. Fen owned most of the body count. She was already running through a post-combat warm-down ritual, stepping backward through the forms she'd executed in the brief battle and whispering their names to herself. Penny was carefully casting a sleep spell on the satyr that Elliot had stuck to the ceiling, while Anaïs watched, impatient to administer the coup de grâce. Quentin noted with the pettiest possible annoyance that they had the satyr without the buckler, which meant that Dint had burned the satyr with the buckler, which meant that he couldn't loot the buckler for himself. He had a crusty, dried mustache from his bloody nose. That wasn't so bad, he told himself. This wasn't such a nightmare. He risked a shuddering sigh of relief. Was that really it? Had they gotten everything? Janet had finally thawed from her frozen state and was busy with something. Unlike everything else they'd seen, the fleshy, headless, four-legged creature was neither humanoid nor obviously related to any terrestrial fauna. It was radially symmetrical, like a starfish, with no obvious front or back or face. It stood unreadable in a dark corner, taking sudden scary little hops in unexpected directions. It had a large, faceted gem embedded in its back. Decoration? Or was that its eye, its brain?
Hey! Fenn snapped her fingers in Janet's direction. Hey!
Evidently she'd forgotten Janet's name.
Leave that! Leave the Grimling to us!
Janet ignored her. She continued to take wary steps toward it. Quentin wished she wouldn't. She was in no kind of emotional state to be working magic.
Janet! He shouted.
Shit! Dint said distinctly. It was a businesslike shit. Another damn mess for him to clean up. He brought his wand back out from wherever he'd stashed it. But before he could act, Janet reached carefully behind her back and brought out something small but heavy. Gripping it with both hands, she made a small adjustment and then fired 5 shots into the creature at close range. The pistol bounced upward with each shot, and each time she carefully re-aimed it. The sound was shattering in the low-ceilinged chamber. 1 shot struck sparks off the jewel in the Grimling's back. It sank to the floor, shivering and deflating like a parade balloon, still expressionless. It made a high, urgent, whistling sound. By the 5th shot, it was visibly dead. Nothing and nobody in the room moved. Janet turned around. The tears she had shed earlier were already dry. She glared at them.
"What the fuck are you looking at?" she said.
It got colder the deeper they went. At 6 stories underground, Quentin was shivering in his heavy sweater and thinking nostalgically about the warm, puffy parkas they'd abandoned way back by the sunny little stream. They broke for a rest in a circular room with a beautiful lapis lazuli spiral inlaid in the floor. Dark green ambient light emanated from somewhere, like the light in an aquarium. Dint sat in the lotus position, wrapped his cape around him and meditated. A gap of about 6 inches separated him from the floor. Fenn did calisthenics. The break was clearly not for their benefit. They were like professional mountaineers impatiently shepherding a herd of rich fat cats up the slopes of Mount Everest. The break Bill's party was a package they were contractually obligated to deliver. Alice sat by herself on a stone bench, her back against a pillar, looking blankly at a mosaic on the wall depicting a sea monster, a creature like an octopus but much larger and with many more than 8 legs. Quentin straddled the bench at the other end, facing her. Her eyes flicked over to his for a long moment. There was not a hint of either contrition or forgiveness in them. He made sure his eyes looked the same. They watched the mosaic. The little squares that made up the sea creature were moving very slowly, rearranging themselves on the wall. The crude blue waves rolled along very gradually. It was easy, decorative magic. There was a bathroom floor at Breakbill's that had much the same effect. Alice felt like a black hole that was trying to pull him in, rip the flesh clean off him with its sheer toxic gravity. Finally, she took out her canteen and used it to wet a spare white sock.
"Let's do something about your nose," she said.
She reached out to dab at his face, but at the last minute he realized he didn't want her to touch him. He took the sock himself, carefully. It turned pink as he wiped at his upper lip.
"So, what was it like," Quentin said, "when you let the demon out?"
Now that the high of combat was gone and she was no longer in danger, his anger came creeping back. The anesthetic was wearing off. It was an effort, not to say anything vicious. She hiked her foot up onto the bench and started undoing the laces on her sneakers.
"It felt good," she said carefully. "I thought it would hurt, but it was kind of a relief. Like sneezing. I never felt I could really breathe with that thing inside me."
Interesting. Did it feel as good as fucking Penny? He'd actually thought he was going to be civil, but it was too hard. The words came out of his mouth of their own malevolent volition. He wondered what else he would say. I've got all kinds of demons inside of me, he thought, not just the one. If he'd managed to hurt Alice, she didn't let it show. She carefully peeled off a sock. A nasty white blister covered the entire ball of her foot. They watched the mosaic some more. A little boat had floated into the scene, a lifeboat maybe, or a launch from a whaler. It was crowded with tiny people. It looked pretty much like a done deal that the sea creature was going to crush the little boat in its many long green arms. That was... She stopped and started over. That wasn't good. So why did you do it? Alice tilted her head thoughtfully, but her face was white. To get back at you? Because I was feeling like shit about myself? Because I didn't think you would care? Because I was drunk and he came on pretty strong, so he raped you? No, Quentin, he did not. Never mind. Stop talking. I don't think I understood how much it would hurt you. Just stop talking. I can't talk to you anymore. I can't hear anything you're saying. He started that little speech, speaking normally, and he ended it shouting. In a way, fighting like this was just like using magic. You said the words, and they altered the universe. By merely speaking, you could create damage and pain, cause tears to fall, drive people away, make yourself feel better, make your life worse. Quentin leaned forward, all the way forward, until he had placed his forehead on the cool marble of the bench in front of him. His eyes were closed. He wondered what time it was. His head felt a little spinny. He could fall asleep right there, he thought, just like this. He wanted to tell Alice he didn't love her, but he couldn't, because it wasn't true. It was the one lie he couldn't quite tell. I wish this were over, Alice said quietly. What? This mission, this adventure, whatever you want to call it. I want to go home. I don't. This is bad, Quentin. Somebody's going to get hurt. Good. I hope they do. If I die doing this, at least I'll have done something. Maybe you'll do something one of these days instead of being such a pathetic little mouse all the time. She said something he didn't catch. What? I said don't talk to me about death. You don't know anything about it. For no reason, and against his express conscious wishes, some very tight elastic band of muscle around Quentin's chest relaxed very slightly. Something between a laugh and a cough escaped him. He sank back against his pillar. God, I am literally losing my fucking mind. Across the room, Anaïs sat with Dint, talking intently and going over a handmade map of their progress so far that he'd sketched on what looked suspiciously like graph paper. Anaïs seemed more like a part of the guide's gang than the Breakbills gang now. As he watched, she bent over the map, deliberately smooshing her tit into Dint's shoulder as she did so. Josh was nowhere to be seen. Penny and Elliot were dozing on the floor in the center of the room, their heads resting on their packs. Elliot had hectored Janet about the gun until he extracted a promise from her to dispose of it responsibly.
"Do you even want this anymore, Quentin?" Alice asked. "I mean, what we're doing here? This kings and queens idea?"
"Of course I do." He'd almost forgotten why they were here. But it was true. A throne was exactly what he needed right now. Once they were ensconced in Castle Whitespire, wreathed in glory and every possible physical comfort, then maybe he could find the strength to come to grips with all this. You'd have to be an idiot not to.
You know the funny thing, though?
She sat up straight, suddenly animated.
I mean, the really hilarious thing? You actually don't. You don't even want it.
Even if this whole thing came off without a hitch, you wouldn't be happy. You gave up on Brooklyn and on break bills, and I fully expect you to give up on Fillory when the time comes. It makes things very simple for you, doesn't it? Well, and of course you were always going to give up on us. We had problems, but we could have fixed them. But that was too easy for you. It might actually have worked, and then where would you be? You would have been stuck with me forever.
Problems? We had problems?
People looked up. He dropped his voice to a furious whisper.
You fucked fucking Penny! I'd say that's a fucking problem!
Alice ignored this. If he didn't know better, he would have said that the tone of her voice almost resembled tenderness. I will stop being a mouse, Quentin. I will take some chances. If you will, for just one second, look at your life and see how perfect it is. Stop looking for the next secret door that is going to lead you to your real life. Stop waiting. This is it. There's nothing else. It's here. And you'd better decide to enjoy it, or you're going to be miserable wherever you go, for the rest of your life, forever.
You can't just decide to be happy.
No, you can't. But you can sure as hell decide to be miserable. Is that what you want? Do you want to be the asshole who went to Fillory and was miserable there, even in Fillory? Because that's who you are right now.
There was something true about what Alice was saying. But he couldn't grasp it. It was too complex, or too simple, too something.
He thought of that first week he'd spent at Breakbills, when he and Elliot had gone sculling, and they'd watched the other rowers hunching and shivering in what, to Quentin, was a warm summer day. That was what he looked like to Alice. It was strange. He thought that doing magic was the hardest thing he would ever do, but the rest of it was so much harder. It turned out that magic was the easy part.
"Why did you come here, Alice?" he said. "If you don't even want this."
She looked at him evenly.
"Why do you think, Quentin?" "I came because of you. I came here because I wanted to take care of you."
Quentin looked around at the others. He saw Janet sitting with her back against one wall with her eyes closed, though Quentin didn't get the sense that she was asleep. The revolver was cradled in her lap. She wore a red T-shirt with a white star on it and khaki pants. She must be cold, he thought. As he watched, she sighed and licked her lips without opening her eyes, like a little girl. He didn't want to be cold. Alice was still watching him. Behind her, the mosaic was a swirl of green tentacles and white caps and floating fragments. He slid down the stone bench to her end and kissed her and bit her lower lip until she gasped. After a certain point, it was no longer possible to ignore the fact that they were lost. The hallways wound fiendishly and branched frequently. They were in a maze, and they were not solving it. Dint had become obsessive about his map, which now stretched to half a dozen sheets of graph paper that he shuffled and scribbled on intently whenever they turned a corner. At Breakbills, they'd learned a spell that would leave glowing footprints behind them, but Dint thought it would just lead predators straight to them. The walls were carved with ranks of crude marching figures in profile, thousands of them, each one holding a different totem, a palm leaf, a torch, a key, a sword, a pomegranate. It was darker here. They kept piling on light spells to anything that would take one, but the glow just didn't seem to go as far. They fast-walked down the corridor, double time now. The mood was that of a picnic threatened by lightning. The corridor branched and branched again, and intermittently dead-ended, forcing them to backtrack. Quentin's feet hurt in his brand-new hiking boots. A stray spur of something hard stabbed him in the same spot on his left ankle every time he took a step. He risked a glance back the way they'd come. There was a red glow back there. Something somewhere in the maze was throwing off a deep crimson light. He felt a deep-seated lack of interest in finding out what it was. 10 minutes later, they got hung up at a fork in the passageway, Dint vigorously supporting the right fork, Josh making the case, admittedly, largely on intangibles, that the other forked looked way more promising and just feels more like what we want. The walls were painted with oddly convincing trompe-l'œil landscapes now, crowded with tiny dancing figures. Doors slammed open and shut in the distance. The hallway was brightening behind them. They all saw it now. It was like a subterranean sun was rising. Discipline was getting ragged. They broke into a half run, and it was too dark for Quentin to be absolutely sure that nobody lagged behind. He focused on Alice. She was panting. The back of her blouse gaped palely open where the demon had torn its way out. He could see her black bra strap, which had somehow survived the operation. He wished he had a jacket to give her. He caught up with Dint. "We should slow down," Quentin panted. "We're going to lose somebody." Dint shook his head. "They're tracking us now. If we stop, they'll mob us."
"What the fuck, man? Didn't you plan for this?"
"This is the plan, Earthchild," Dint snarled back. "You don't like it? Go home. We need kings and queens in Fillory. Is that not a thing worth dying for?"
Not really, Quentin thought.
Asshole. That slutty nymph was right.
This is not your war.
They bowled through a door into a tapestry that was apparently concealing it from the other side. Behind the tapestry was a candle-lit banquet hall set with food, fresh and steaming. They were alone. It was as if the waiters who placed the dishes there had just moments earlier scampered out of sight. The table stretched out in both directions with no endpoints. The tapestries were rich and detailed, the silverware gleaming, the crystal goblets full of wine, deep gold and arterial purple. They stopped and stared in both directions, blinking. It was like they had stumbled into the dream of a starving man.
"Nobody eats," Dint called. "Don't touch it. Nobody eats. Nobody drinks."
"There are too many entrances,"
Anais said, her pretty green eyes flicking in all directions.
"They can attack us."
She was right. A door opened farther down the hall, admitting two large, rangy individuals of the monkey family, though Quentin couldn't have said exactly what to call them. Their glazed simian eyes looked bored. In perfect synchrony, they dipped their hands into pouches slung over their shoulders and came up with golf-sized lead balls. With a practiced wind-up of their overdeveloped shoulders and overlong arms, they whipped the balls at the group at big-league fastball speeds. Quentin grabbed Alice's hand, and they cowered back behind a heavy tapestry which caught one of the balls. The other one clipped a candlestick on the table and then spectacularly vaporized 4 wine glasses in a row. Under other circumstances, Quentin thought, that would actually have been cool. Elliot touched his forehead, where he'd been hit by a shard of glass. His fingers came away bloody.
"Would somebody please kill those things, please?"
Janet said disgustedly. She was crouched under the table.
"Seriously," Josh complained through clenched teeth, "this shit isn't even mythological. We need some unicorns or something up in this piece."
"Janet," Elliot said, "do your demon."
"I already did," she yelled back. "I did it the night after graduation. I felt sorry for it."
Huddling behind the rough fabric of the tapestry, Quentin watched a pair of legs stroll by, unhurriedly. While the rest of them hunkered down, Penny strode confidently toward the two ball throwers as they wound up again, no expressions on their stiff, monkey faces. He was gesturing fast with both hands and singing an incantation in a high, clear tenor. Calm and serious in the shifting candlelight, wearing just a t-shirt and jeans, he looked much less like a puffy wannabe than he used to. He looked like a hardened young battle mage. Was that how he'd looked to Alice, Quentin wondered, the night she slept with him? With one hand, Penny stopped a lead ball in midair. Then a second. They hovered there, unsupported for a moment, like surprised hummingbirds, before they recovered their weight and dropped to the floor.
With the other hand, Penny lobbed back a fiery seed that grew and expanded like an unfurling parachute. The tapestries on either side of the hall blazed where the fireball brushed them. It engulfed the two monkeys, and when it dissipated, they were simply gone, and a 10-foot section of the banquet table was a roaring bonfire.
"Yeah!" Penny yelled, momentarily forgetting his fillery speak. "Boom, bitches!"
"Amateur," Dint muttered.
"If my hairline is messed up," Elliot said weakly, "I will bring those things back to life and kill them all over again."
They retreated along the banquet hall in the opposite direction, awkwardly shuffling past the straight-backed wooden chairs. The hall was just too narrow. With the table in the center, there wasn't enough room for them to form up properly. The setup had a zany Scooby-Doo feeling. Quentin took a running step and half-leaped, half-slid across the banquet table, clearing dishes as he went, feeling like an action hero sliding across the Firebird-emblazoned hood of his muscle car. A curious Alice in Wonderland menagerie was crowding into the hall from either side. As military order broke down in the room, so did taxonomical order. Species and body parts were mashed up seemingly at random. Had everything collapsed after the Chatwins left, to the point where humans and animals interbred? There were ferrets and rabbits, giant mice and loping monkeys, and a vicious-looking fisher. But there were also men and women with the heads of animals, an astute-looking fox-headed man who appeared to be preparing a spell, a woman with a thick-necked lizard head with huge independent eyes, an oddly dignified pike-bearer upon whose shoulders swayed the sinuous neck and tiny head of a pink flamingo. Fen plucked a sharp knife off the banquet table, gripped the blade carefully between her thumb and forefinger, and threw it spinning so that it took the foxman point first in the eye socket.
"Move!" she barked. "Everybody, fall back! Don't let them bog us down! We have to be close now!"
They fell back along the length of the banquet hall. The basic idea was to try to keep a coherent line of scrimmage between them and their attackers, but the line kept getting disrupted. One of their party would get hung up, the chairs kept getting in the way, or the tomb dwellers would group together and make a charge, or worse, one of them would blunder in from the side through a hidden door straight into the center of their party. He and Alice managed to hold hands for the first 10 seconds, but after that it just wasn't possible. This wasn't like the earlier fights. The whole thing kept degenerating into the running of the bulls. The hall seemed to go on forever. Possibly it did. The candles and mirrors and food gave the whole scene an incongruously festive air. Even if they decided to take the button home, at this point it would be hard to muster everybody in one place to actually do it. Quentin jogged along with his knife out, though he didn't know if he was capable of using it. He felt like he had in gym class, trying to look like part of the team, while at the same time desperately hoping nobody would pass him the ball. A giant house cat popped out from behind a tapestry right in front of him, and Fen almost certainly saved Quentin's life by cannoning fearlessly into the thing so that they rolled together on the floor, grappling and thrashing, until she knocked it out with a furious ink-aga headbutt. Quentin gave her a hand up, and they ran on. Dint was putting on a show. He'd hopped spryly up onto the banquet table and was striding along it, rapping out percussive syllables with astonishing speed and fluency, his wand tucked back behind his ear. His long black hair crackled, and crazy energies flashed out from the tips of his long fingers. Sometimes he actually had two different spells going simultaneously, Quentin noticed, a primary attack in one hand and a second, lesser piece of witchery simmering in his offhand. At one point he made his arms swell up hugely, picked up two chairs in each giant hand, and clubbed down a half-dozen opponents with them in three business-like swings, left, right, left. Penny managed to persuade a section of the table to rear up like an angry centipede and attack the Philorians until they chopped it to pieces. Even Quentin got off a couple of sweaty-palmed magic missiles into the press.
Fenn's tunic was soaked with sweat. She closed her eyes and placed her palms together, whispering, and when she parted them, they gleamed with a terrible white phosphorescence. The next foe she met, a sinewy scimitar-wielder who was either wearing a leopard skin or was half-leopard from the waist up, she shouted and punched her fist through its chest up to her shoulder. But the close calls were getting closer. The situation was disintegrating, and they needed an exit strategy. The corridor was filling with bodies and smoke. Quentin's breath whistled through his teeth, and in his head he was singing a psychotic nonsense song. Somewhere along the line, Quentin left his knife in a furry Philorian stomach. He never saw the creature's face. It was a creature, not a person, not a person, not a person. But later he would remember the sensation of jamming it in, how the blade punched through the tough, rubbery muscles of the diaphragm and then slid easily into the underlying viscera, and how the muscles gripped the blade after it was in. He snatched his hand away from the hilt like it was electrified. Quentin registered first Josh, then Elliot, hunching their shoulders and letting loose their cacodemons. Elliot's was particularly awesome-looking, banded from head to foot in horizontal yellow and black danger stripes. It slid sideways across the smooth table, scrabbling like a flung cat, then charged into the fray with unself-conscious glee, clinging and tearing and leaping and clinging again.
"God damn it!" Janet was screaming. "What else? What the fuck else?"
"This is bullshit!" Elliot yelled hoarsely. "Side door! Pick a side door and go through it!"
There was a moment of premonitory silence, as if some of the creatures actually sensed what was going to happen next. Then the floor jolted, and a giant man made of glowing, red-hot iron shouldered his way sideways through the wall. He took the whole wall down with him. A flying brick nicked Fenn's head, and she dropped like she'd been shot. Waves of heat poured off the giant, warping the air around him, and anything he touched burned. He stood bent over, hands on the floor. He was about a third again, too tall for the confined space of the banquet hall. His eyes were molten gold, with no pupils. Dust filled the air. The giant put his foot on Fenn's prostrate body, and she burst into flames. Everybody ran. Anybody who fell was trampled. The heat coming off the man's smooth red skin was unbearable. Quentin would have done anything to put distance between it and himself. There were pile-ups at the nearest exits. Quentin pushed past them and farther down the hall. He looked around for Alice and couldn't even find anybody human until he risked a look back and saw Josh standing in the middle of the hallway, all alone. He seemed to be undergoing one of his freakish power surges. He'd summoned another of his miniature black holes the way he'd done that day on the Welter's pitch. It had nearly swallowed a tree that day. Now, as Quentin watched, an entire length of tapestry wavered toward it and then flowed into it all at once, ripping free of its curtain rod with a sound like a fusillade of pistol shots. The light in the hall dimmed and became amber. The red giant was momentarily stalled by this. He was squatting down, studying the apparition, apparently fascinated by it. He was bald, and his expression was blank. His huge, hairless, glowing red cock and balls swung loose between his thighs like the clapper of a bell. Then Quentin was alone and running along a cool, dark side corridor. It was silent. The noise switched off like a TV. He was sprinting, flat out, and then he was running, then jogging, and then, after a while, he was just walking. It was over. He couldn't run anymore. The air scorched his lungs. He bent over and put his hands on his knees. His back itched painfully behind his right shoulder, and when he reached back to scratch, he found an arrow dangling from the hump of muscle there. Unthinkingly, he pulled it out, and a freshet of blood trickled down his back, but there wasn't much pain. It had only gone in an inch, probably not even that far. He was almost glad it hurt. The pain was something to hang on to. He held the wooden shaft, grateful to have something solid in his hands. The silence was amazing. He was safe again. For a few minutes he allowed himself to luxuriate in the simple joys of breathing cool air, of not running, of being alone in the semi-darkness, and not in immediate danger of dying. But the gravity of the situation kept seeping through, messily, until he could no longer blot it up. He could be the last one alive, for all he knew. He had no idea how to get back up to the surface. He could die down here. He felt the weight of the dirt and rock over his head. He was buried alive. Even if he made it out, he didn't have the button. He had no way to get back to Earth. Footsteps in the darkness. Somebody was coming, walking. The figure's hands were glowing with a light charm. Wearily, Quentin started in on yet another magic missile spell, but before he could finish, he realized it was just Elliot. He let his hands drop and sagged to the floor. Neither of them spoke. They just leaned together against the wall, side by side. The cold stone soothed the little divot of pain the arrow had punched in Quentin's back. Elliot's shirt was untucked. His face was all smudged with soot on one side. He would have been furious if he'd known. "You all right?" Elliot nodded. "Fenn's dead," Quentin said. Elliot took a deep breath and ran his glowing hands through his thick, wavy hair.
"I know. I saw."
"I don't think there's anything we could have done," Elliot said. "Big Red back there was just out of our league, that's all." They fell silent. It was like the words had spun off into some void where they had no meaning. They'd lost any connection with the world. Or maybe it was the world that had peeled away from the words. Elliot passed him a flask with something strong in it, and he drank and passed it back. It seemed to restore some link between him and his body. Quentin drew his knees up and hugged them. "I got hit by an arrow," he said. It felt like a stupid thing to say. "In my back."
"We should go," Elliot said.
"Right.
Backtrack. Try to meet back up with the others. Penny's got the button."
It was amazing that Elliot could still be so practical after everything that had happened. He was so much stronger than Quentin was. "That big glowing guy, though."
"Yeah.
Maybe he's still back there." Elliot shrugged.
"We have to get to the button."
Quentin was thirsty, but there was no water. He couldn't remember when he'd dropped his pack. "I'll tell you something funny," Elliot said after a while. "I think Anaïs hooked up with Dint."
"What?"
In spite of himself, Quentin smiled. He felt his dry lips crack.
"When did they even have time?"
"Bathroom break, after that second fight." "Wow, tough break for Josh. But you have to applaud their initiative."
"Definitely. But hard cheese on Josh."
"Hard cheese." It was the kind of thing they used to say back at break bills. "I'll tell you something else funny," Elliot went on.
"I don't regret coming here. Even now that it's all gone to shit, I'm still glad I came. Could that possibly be the stupidest thing I've ever said to you? But it's the truth. I think I was going to drink myself to death back on Earth."
It was true. For Elliot, there hadn't been any other way. Somehow that made it a little bit better. "You could still drink yourself to death here."
"At this rate, I won't have the chance."
Quentin stood up. His legs were stiff and achy. He did a deep knee bend. They started back the way they came. Quentin didn't feel any fear anymore. That part of it was over, except that he was worried about Alice. The adrenaline was gone, too. Now he was just thirsty, and his feet hurt, and he was covered in scratches he couldn't remember having gotten. The blood on his back had dried, sticking his shirt to the arrow wound. It tugged uncomfortably every time he took a step. It became apparent pretty soon that he didn't have anything to worry about anyway, because they couldn't even find their way back to the banquet hall. They must have taken a wrong turn somewhere, maybe several. They stopped and tried some basic pathfinding magic, but Quentin's tongue felt thick and clumsy, and neither of them could seem to get the words quite right, and anyway they really needed a dish of olive oil to make it work properly. Quentin couldn't think of anything to say. He waited while Elliot took a piss against the stone wall. It felt like they'd come to the end, but they had no choice but to keep walking. Maybe this is still part of the story, he thought numbly. The bad part, right before everything comes out all right. He wondered what time it was on the surface. He felt like he'd been up all night. The masonry of the walls was older now, crumblier. For short stretches it was just dusty, unworked cave rock. They were at the very outer fringes of this subterranean universe, wandering among badly eroded planets and dim, decaying stars. The hallway had ceased to branch now. It contented itself with curving gently to the left, and Quentin thought he could feel the curve getting gradually tighter, like it was spiraling inward, like the interior corridors of a nautilus shell. He figured it stood to reason, what little reason was left in the world, that there was a geometrical limit to how far it could keep curving in on itself before they came to something. Pretty soon, it turned out he was right. The ram. Just like that, there they all were. Quentin and Elliot stood at the edge of a large, round, underground chamber, blinking at bright torchlight. It was different from the rooms they'd already seen, in that it appeared to be naturally occurring. The floor was sandy, the ceiling craggy and irregular and unworked, with stalactites and other rocky excrescences poking down that you wouldn't want to hit your head on. The air was chilly and damp and still. Quentin could hear an underground stream gurgling somewhere. He couldn't see where. The sound had no origin or direction. The others were here, too, all of them except for poor Finn. Josh and Alice were in an entrance a little ways over. Janet stood in another archway, looking lost and bedraggled. Dint and Anaïs were in the next one over, and Penny was alone in the one after that. They stood in the doorways like contestants framed in the spangled, light-bulb archways of a game show. It was a miracle. It even looked like they'd all just arrived at the exact same moment. Quentin took a deep breath. Relief flooded through him like a warm, liquid transfusion. He was just so fucking glad to see every last one of them. Even Dint. Good old Dint, you hound dog. Even Penny, and only partly because he still had his pack, presumably with the button still inside. The story's outcome was still in play, after all. Even after everything had gone wrong, it could still all turn out basically okay. It was a disaster, but a mitigated disaster. It was still possible that 5 years from now, when they were more or less over their post-traumatic stress disorder, they'd all get a big kick out of getting together and talking about it. Maybe the real Fillory wasn't that different from the Fillory he'd always wanted, after all. Kings and queens, Quentin thought. Kings and queens. Glory has its price. Did you not know that? A block of stone stood in the center of the room. On it was a large, shaggy sheep, or no, it had horns, so that made it a ram. It lay with its eyes closed, its legs folded under it, its chin resting on a crown, a simple golden circlet snuggled between its two shaggy front knees. Quentin wasn't sure if it was asleep or dead, or just a very lifelike statue. He took a tentative, exploratory step into the room, feeling like a man setting foot on shore after a long and grievous afternoon on a storm-tossed yacht. The sandy floor felt reassuringly solid. "I didn't know," he called hoarsely to Alice. "I wasn't sure if you were still alive or not."
Josh thought Quentin was talking to him. His comical face was ashen. He looked like a ghost seeing a ghost.
I know,
he coughed wetly into his fist.
What the hell happened? Did you fight that thing?
Josh nodded shakily.
Sort of. I felt a big spell coming on, so I just went with it. I think I finally felt what you guys feel. I called up one of those swirly black holes. He looked at it, then he looked at me with those freaky gold eyes. Then it just sucked him in, head first, just ate him. I saw his big red legs sticking out, kicking, and I just booked it out of there. Did you check out his dick, though? That guy was hung.
Quentin and Alice embraced without speaking. The others made their way over. Stories were exchanged. It was a reunion. Somehow, everybody had managed to make it out of the banquet hall unscathed, or at least not too badly scathed. Anaïs showed everybody where her golden curls got crisped off in the back as she ran. Janet was the only one who hadn't escaped out a side door. Instead, she ran all the way to the end of the hall, which it turned out did have an end, after all, though it took her an hour to get there. 3 years of cross-country, she said proudly. She'd even had a glass of wine with no ill effects, apart from mild intoxication. They all shook their heads. What they'd all been through. Nobody would ever believe it. Quentin was so tired he could hardly think, except to think, "We did it. We really did it." Elliot passed the flask and everybody drank. It had been a game at first, and then it all got horribly real. But now it was starting to feel like a game again, something like what they'd been imagining on that terrible, wonderful morning back in Manhattan. Good fun, a real adventure. After a while, they ran out of things to say, just stood in a circle, looking at each other and shaking their heads with silly, punch-drunk smiles on their faces. A deep, dry cough interrupted them.
Welcome.
It was the Ram. He had opened his eyes.
Welcome, children of Earth.
Welcome, too,
here he acknowledged Dint.
You valiant child of Fillory. I am Ember.
He was sitting up. He had the strange, horizontal, peanut-shaped pupils that sheep have. His thick wool was the color of pale gold. His ears stuck out comically beneath the heavy horns that curled back magnificently from his forehead. Of them all, only Penny knew what to do. He dropped his backpack and walked over to stand in front of the Ram. He got down on his knees in the sand and bowed his head.
"We sought a crown," he said grandly, "but we have found a king. My Lord Ember, it is my honor and privilege to offer you my fealty."
"Thank you, my child."
The Ram's eyes half closed, gravely and joyfully. Thank God was all Quentin could think. Literally, thank God. It was really him. It was the only explanation. It wasn't like they'd done anything especially heroic to deserve this re-reversal of fortune. Ember must have brought them here. He had saved them. This was it, the closing credits. They'd won. The coronation could begin. He looked from Penny to the Ram and back. He could hear feet shuffling on the sandy floor. Somebody else besides Penny was kneeling. Quentin didn't turn to see who. He stayed standing. For some reason, he wasn't ready to kneel down. Not yet. He would in a minute, but somehow this didn't feel like the moment. Though it would have been nice. He'd been walking for so long. He wasn't sure what to do with his hands, so he clasped them together over his crotch. Ember was talking, but Quentin's mind glossed over the words. They had a certain boilerplate quality. He'd always skipped over Ember's and Umber's speeches in the books, too. Come to think of it, if this was Ember, where was Umber? Normally you never saw them apart.
with your help. It is time we resumed our rightful stewardship over this land. Together we shall go forth from this place and restore glory to Fillory, the glory of